The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, today is a very special day for Theravadan Buddhists. We're at Theravadan Buddhist Center here. And it's a full moon night tonight. And this full moon day in May is called the Vesak or Vesak. And it's a day where in Theravadan countries they celebrate the Buddha's birth, the Buddha's enlightenment, awakening, and the Buddha's death. And so you can imagine with that all those important dates kind of celebrated on the same day, it's probably the most sacred day in the tradition. And it's quite common for people to in those countries, in Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, for lay people to go to a monastery at that time, and the monks will gather as well. And one of the primary activities for the day is to recollect the Buddha and to cultivate or tap into an appreciation for the Buddha. And the act of cultivating, thinking about, contemplating the Buddha, appreciating the Buddha in some active way is considered to be one of the important practices in Theravadan Buddhism, recollecting the Buddha. And it's supposed to help elevate the mind. It's supposed to help concentrate the mind and direct the mind to the possibility of its own awakening at some point. And I think the act of appreciation of something that's beautiful is very important, because I believe in some degree, maybe a small degree, what we appreciate, we become. Or we kind of take on those qualities, or those qualities in us get strengthened, or get mirrored, or get reinforced, or something like that. And so the act of appreciation is actually quite important. If we appreciate violence, then that part of us gets fed or gets developed. If we appreciate peace, that part of us becomes stronger. So one of the things that is done in the recollection of the Buddha is recollecting or appreciating the qualities of the Buddha as they've kind of been recorded and come down to us. And as I thought about this today, and how this is a special day to recollect the Buddha, the contrast between the idea, the image, the archetype of the Buddha, and what I read about in the paper today stood out quite starkly. And there's all kinds of things in the paper. But the thing that jumped out at me was the San Francisco Chronicle, the front page article about violence in the grade schools in the Bay Area, and how, or in California, and how the amount of suspensions that students have had for some kind of acts of violence in I guess K to 12th grade in California has increased over the last year, and that some of the amount of suspensions in the Bay Area in some of the schools is really astounding. The highest school in the Bay Area, it was a school in San Francisco, where there were 40 suspensions for every 100 students in the school. Now, some of those might be been repeated suspensions, but still, 40. And that was the highest. And then there were some 35 and 24%, and, you know, it goes on and on. And you know, the tremendous challenge of going to go to school, and then in school to be in an environment where you have to be afraid, is, I think certainly a challenge to education, but also it's a challenge to grow up in a healthy way in that kind of environment. Richard Shankman, who's one of the people who teaches mindfulness in the schools, teaches mindfulness in the Oakland school system. And in Oakland, there's a fair number of kids who come also from environments which are quite violent. And they come to school somewhat traumatized from that. They come traumatized. And what they're finding there is that the mindfulness, teaching kids just 10, 15 minutes of mindfulness in the classroom, little meditation and things, has a huge effect on some of these kids, because it's the only time in their environment where they have, where it's safe for them to close the eyes and feel comfortable or safe. And all this stuff, variety of stuff, gets released or opens up. But just to have that peace. There was one child who wrote how wonderful it was to do this meditation, and it was the only time he felt peace besides going to the gravesite of his grandmother. So it's kind of quite something. That's the only place for peace in his life. So the contrast of the Buddha and violence in our society, and there's lots of other examples. The contrast of the Buddha also with what goes on in Burma, not only with the Burmese government's response to it, but the fact that there is tens and tens of thousands of people who are suffering this natural calamity, the cyclone that came through and destroyed much of their lives, like in China as well with the earthquake there. So for me, that contrast stands quite strong. And the Buddha is meant to be, in a sense, a contrast, because the Buddha represents a possibility of a way to respond to this challenge, the greatest challenges of our lives. It's not meant to be stress reduction, but rather the greatest existential dilemmas, struggles that human beings face. And he represents someone who faced those, and then we see what he looks like, you know, at least in the archetype of the statue. He doesn't come across as someone who is a fighter, you know, he's not pushing and asserting himself on us. He's not someone who's defensive, you know, cowering, retreating. He's not someone who kind of comes through with hate or comes through with great distress or great doubt or great greed, but rather some very different kind of image comes across here of someone who is grounded, stable, at peace, centered, confident, and present in some very full way. What you probably don't know is that generally the statues are made with his eyes half open, so he's actually aware and connected to the world. He's not withdrawn. And he also has this peaceful smile that represents his inner peace. We have in the library a statue of the classic image of the Buddha as he was dying. And he's lying down in a peaceful, meditative way. And it shows this kind of person who's self-composed, present, confident, and who faces one of the greatest challenges that many people will face consciously. Some people don't do it consciously, I guess. Facing their own death. And he does it consciously with peace and grace. So, we don't know a lot about who the Buddha was. It's hard to pull the tease apart the myth that was created from what actually happened. But what's interesting, I think, is the myth of the Buddha. These mythic stories of him, the stories that evolved in him, have been very powerful motivators for millions of people. Whether they're actually literally true or not, they work as kind of very profound myths in people's lives. And many people see themselves in the stories or the elements of the story. Not literally, but many of the milestones or many of the transition points in the Buddha's life can be somewhat easily reinterpreted to kind of be your own story as well, and your own possibility. When I think about the Buddha who lived so long ago, they say, we're not so sure about even the date exactly, but I believe in the Theravadan world, we're celebrating the 2,552nd year from the time that he died. So what does someone so long ago in ancient times have to say that's helpful for us in our modern times? And isn't it archaic and primitive and a variety of things? And what strikes me when I read the teachings of the Buddha is how modern they seem and how relevant many of them seem to be still to this modern world. And I think it's not a coincidence, because I think that there was perhaps a great pivotal point for much of human civilization around different places on the planet around 400, 500, 600 BC, where there was a kind of there was enough kind of development of culture, of civilization, of variety of things, that there was a profound change in people's ability to self-reflect. And certainly we can use our imagination to realize that, you know, if we take evolution as the linear development, that there was a time when living beings, our ancestors, didn't have self-reflective abilities. And then at some point, the ability to realize, oh, I'm here, and only that I'm here, I'm different than someone else, and I'm different not only that, but there's a future, there's tomorrow, and there's yesterday, and in fact that I'm not going to be here forever, and what are my own capacities? What can I develop? What's happening to me? What's the cause and conditions for my happiness? What are the cause and conditions for my suffering, for the situation in my life? That takes self-reflection. And, you know, I think lower forms of life don't have the same level of self-reflection as we do now. So where did that tipping point come? Where did that come when self-reflection became a key ingredient for human beings? Last summer, I took my four-year-old son to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. And there was artistic three-dimensional rendering, kind of a sculpture that was, I don't know how big, 20 by 20 or something, of reconstruction of a Neanderthal gravesite. And this Neanderthal fellow had died, and they'd put him up, wrapped him up somehow, and put him in this little hole in the ground they dug. And the other people were around doing something, sprinkling flowers in or leaves in, or I don't remember anymore. But it was clearly a kind of ritual marking of this person's death. And my four-year-old was completely fascinated and disturbed because it was a statue, but he'd never confronted death. And he said, that's what happens when you die. And it was quite something. So here, this idea of self-reflection, what happens to you, what happens to the people around you, takes reflection. So in the hundreds of years before the Buddha in India, there was intense self-reflection among some people, where they were trying to come to some understanding about the human condition. And not because they were just kind of abstract philosophers, because the human condition was something that they had to contend with and deal with. They saw around them, and they saw themselves, sickness, old age, and death, the struggles. They saw the possibilities of somehow trying to figure out, how do you make a difference in this world? How do you make a difference for yourself and your community around you, so that you can become happier or safer or have a better future for yourself? How can you prevent some of the tremendous calamities that can befall people? And what is the cause and effect phenomena that comes into play that makes a difference for our well-being and our welfare? So there was intense kind of exploration of this, and some of the solutions people came to was had to do with gods. If you pray and make offerings to the gods will make sure that you're happy. And if you don't please the gods, then you're going to be in trouble. And that was kind of a solution to try to make sense of this. Make sense, why does things happen to people? Why do bad things happen? Why do good things happen? What role do we have in this kind of play of our life? And so there was this intense speculation, exploration in India before the Buddha for this. And people came up with a lot of different theories and ideas to try to make some sense of this life. Again, this very intense use of our ability to be self-reflective, to think about ourselves, to think about this life of ours. So the Buddha, in a sense, inherited many hundreds of years of this intense self-reflection. And he processed it, he took it in, but, as it was there in his environment. And so he set out on his spiritual quest with the support of all that. And he also was part of this self-reflective movement. Some of the mythic qualities of the Buddha as he set out for his quest was that, to borrow from another myth, he lived kind of a life of Eden. As a young man, child and young man. This is his life was depicted as he lived in three different wonderful palaces. He was protected from the distress and difficulties of life. There was walled palaces. He was protected from sickness, sick people, old people, dead people. He didn't see those. And kind of isolated from the difficulties of life. And just all these pleasurable things were brought to him, musicians and food and opportunities and education, all these things. And the innocence of that, innocence of being protected in a way that some of us try to do a little bit to some degree with our children as well. At some point, there's a kind of going beyond your own house, going beyond your own neighborhood, going beyond whatever, the innocence that sooner or later, sometimes it's much sooner, too soon perhaps in some communities, and sometimes it's later, that we look beyond and realize, wait a minute, it's not just an Eden here. It's not just a wonderful world for the people who have a wonderful world. It's there are challenges here. There are difficulties here. So the Buddha came to this pivotal point where he was kind of disillusioned, or he woke up from some kind of state of innocence or not knowing, and it deeply troubled him. And in deeply being troubled by it, he really wanted to find a way, find a solution to this existential dilemma, or this dilemma, this issue of how do people get happy? How do people suffer? What's our role? What's our responsibility? What do we do with all this? Remember, this is a time before people had the kind of psychological understanding that modern people have nowadays. So the understanding of how our own psychology comes into play, wasn't there in the way that it was now. So it was all explorations, all kind of discovering things new, pioneers in a way. So with his tremendous drive to deal with this, to work with this, he couldn't go off on retreat. He couldn't go off to university and do the studies that we can do now. Those things didn't exist back in those times. And in that drive, he left his family and went off and became a renunciant to try to explore this, to deal with it. And it said that he studied with some of the great teachers of his time and became disillusioned that they didn't have a solution to what he was looking for. And then he had a remarkable memory. And this was a pivotal memory for this process he was going through. And that is, he remembered a time when he was 6 years old, when he was left alone at the edge of a field that was being plowed, a beautiful spring day underneath a rose apple tree. And he sat upright, and in that peaceful place where nothing was asked of him, no one was asking him to do anything or perform anything or expecting anything of him. He was kind of like forgotten there while everybody was on the field plowing, the ceremonial plowing of the first plowing of the spring. He fell into a state of well-being, peaceful well-being, joy, happiness. And when he was 36, he remembered that experience when he was 6. And an experience that he'd forgotten. And I do know there are some people who have experiences of well-being as a child that are forgotten, lost touch with as they get older. And some people, when they meditate, that's when they remember. Wow, you know, it's like they're reclaiming or rediscovering a possibility. So he remembered something that happened to him when he was 6 years old. And in this intense exploration, self-reflective exploration, that he'd exhausted all the possibilities he knew of at the time, he thought, wait a minute, maybe that sense of well-being or joy that I had as a child, that's a new route. That's a new position or new perspective from which to do this exploration. So he gave up his ascetic practices. He gave up many of the practices he'd done and focused on bringing about this state of concentration that he had as a six-year-old that brought the state of joy and happiness. And with that, he developed further states of concentration, further states of well-being. And what he discovered was that in order to use our self-reflective ability to see deeply and clearly enough, you had to have a mind which was not agitated, that was not tormented, not suffering. It's best to have a mind that was filled with well-being, that was stable, happy, contented. That's an ideal condition from which to see deeply and clearly into this life of ours. So then he sat there, cultivating these deeper states. And then, in fact, what happened was he did see very deeply. And they said he saw so deeply that it transformed him from, they say in Buddhism, an ordinary person to an awakened person. And so the question is, what was it that happened? And it provided the solution to the quest that he was after. So what was it he saw that allowed that change? Well, what he saw, and it kind of is usually presented in very mythic words, but what he saw was he saw that our happiness, our well-being, at a fundamental level, is not caused by gods, is not caused by genetics, is not caused by karma, not caused by what happened in the past. It's not caused by others, But it really is caused by the ethical quality of our motivations. Is caused by the quality of the choices we make deep in our own minds. So rather than looking at, rather than thinking that our suffering is fixed, one of the theories of ancient times in India was that everyone's allotted a certain amount of suffering at the beginning of time, and in the endless round of rebirth, you just have to go through it all until it's exhausted. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is. But the Buddha said, well, that's not it, because actually we have a role to play in the creation of the suffering, in the arising of the suffering. And so what he saw was the role of our own mind. And this was, and to move the, to take the self-reflective capacity and go far enough back into the mind, or thoroughly enough in the mind to see where the responsibility lies, where the possibility is, where we can really make a difference, was his great contribution. And it wasn't meant to be insult to us, you know, that, oh, you know, you're responsible for your suffering. You know, what do you mean? Terrible things happened to me. The world did the terrible things to me. But what it meant was that if you really want to discover the possibility of this inner stability, peace, compassion, love, confidence, strength that the Buddha represents, you have to find that in yourself. And then once you find it, you go out there to meet the world with that. The image of the Buddha, even though he remained a renunciant, not engaged in household life, he didn't have a job, not conventionally all that, he was someone who spent 45 years after his awakening engaged in the world. Teaching, walking around, meeting people from all status of life, engaging them, helping them, supporting them, meeting people who had horrific things happen to them, and counseling them, helping them, pointing to this possibility in themselves, in them. And he met people who were the highest kind of stations of life, and, you know, conventionally had a wonderful life, and tried to support and help them as well. And so what makes the Buddha's teaching so modern is that I don't think you get more modern than taking the ability to be self-reflective, taking the evolution of humans, you know, taking self-reflective ability, taking to the level where you discover the tools, the practices and tools in the mind to perfect enough, to strengthen enough this self-reflective ability, to look deeply enough in one's own mind to see what it is we do, how we react, how we grab, how we get attached, how we cling, how we get afraid, how we hate, all these different things that come into play that causes the mind to become afraid, hateful, angry, distressed, despondent, depressed, you know, a whole series of different things that, you know, that what we call suffering. And it's not an easy task. But the Buddha saw this place, and more remarkably, he saw it, and he saw the possibility of that place, that the pivotal point in the mind, he saw the possibility of releasing something, letting go of something, and becoming free, becoming awake. And the word Buddha comes from the Indian word bodhi, which means to be awake. And I love this word awake, because I think conventionally many of us have a sense of what it means like to conventionally be awake, especially maybe after a really restful night of sleep, a really restful nap or something. We really feel awake. There's a clarity and a sharpness, alertness. Just the sense of really being awake generally comes with a sense of well-being. There's something peaceful in that place. But the most significant thing about being awake is that when you really feel awake, you know you feel awake. Again, the self-reflective thing. You know you're awake. And that ability to know you're awake creates a freedom and independence in the mind, where some aspect of the mind, the knowing quality of the mind, has become independent of what it knows. So to become awake and take this kind of what I could call the self-reflective ability and setting it free from being entangled with all the things that we can be concerned about in our life. It doesn't mean becoming aloof from life. It means that our awareness is not enmeshed or lost or obsessed with the conditions of the world. So to take the self-reflective ability and perfect it and develop it so the knowing quality of the mind becomes a power and a strength that becomes stronger than the forces within our mind of attachment or clinging or fear. And taking response, seeing how we can make a difference in our mind to move the mind in that direction. And then to set the mind free in this awake state the Buddha represents is what the Buddha was teaching, what he discovered. There are perhaps many people who have kind of been pointing this direction ever since, certainly Buddhists down through the ages, and perhaps in modern psychology, as they're understanding greater, more and more about how the mind works, there's also a greater and greater appreciation of the role of the mind and the role of our own motivations, our own intentions, the ethical qualities of our mind, and how they affect all these things. But the remarkable thing about the Buddha was, at least as it's recorded in history, he was the first. And, you know, sometimes the first is the most difficult. And, you know, it's a huge hurdle to overcome. And so we celebrate, we respect, we appreciate, this person, you know, who's the pioneer, who did this amazing feat that kind of opened the door for us so we can go through that as well and do this. It's not meant for those who are faint-hearted. The Buddha, came from a warrior class in ancient India, and he's usually understood to be someone of tremendous courage. That he's of tremendous courage to do what he did, to face what he had to face, to deal with his own mind in this deep way. It takes a certain amount of courage and wisdom, or commitment to be someone who really loses interest or turns away in a healthy way, turns away from being enamored in the things that people get enamored with that cause them to lose their self-reflective freedom. People get enamored, lost, enchanted in power and money and sex and music and, you know, all kinds of stuff. War. It takes courage. And so to me, when I reflect on the Buddha, I think of someone who's courageous. I think of someone who is willing to use that courage to sit down, not passively, even though it looks passive to sit this way, but in a way that was tremendously active, powerful, dynamic. And in that dynamism, discovered a peace, a stillness, that's kind of like the stillness of a flame, a candle flame, which is unwavering. No wind agitating it. It's very dynamic, that flame, but it's completely still. And sometimes if you look, and this is probably physically, in physics is not accurate, but sometimes when I look at a candle flame, what I see is I see a little gap between the wick and the flame. The flame is free. Not exactly free, but what they say in Buddhism is that nirvana, which is what the Buddha discovered, is like a candle flame that's been extinguished, where it's really free. But it sounds like some kind of nihilism to think of, you know, the mind has been extinguished or something. But in the ancient physics of India, a flame is never extinguished. When a flame goes out, the heat doesn't disappear. The flame doesn't disappear. The heat element is freed from the candle, and is set free and goes out everywhere in a way that cannot be defined or described. And so so rather than being some kind of nihilistic idea, it's actually meant to be a very freeing idea. The candle going out means it's traveling out. It's been set free. Not that it's been extinguished. And so the mind of a Buddha is a mind that's been set free. And it's said that a mind of the Buddha cannot be defined. So, you know, conventionally we say, oh, this guy's a Buddha, he's a monk or whatever. But, you know, who was the Buddha? It's an interesting question. It's a profound question. And it's a different kind of question than you'd say, you know, like, who was Abraham Lincoln? You know, you say Abraham Lincoln, but mostly you know, he's a president, and you mostly say what he did. Say, who's the Buddha? Who he was, you know, this guy long ago, is not so important. It's what his mind is. What happened inside of him, psychologically. That's what we want to know. And it said we can't actually define that. In the way that if you see someone walking down the street, you might be able to see if they're in a grumpy mood. Their grumpiness defines them. Or you see someone is walking down the street and they seem very friendly. Oh, that's a friendly person. And you can kind of, or you see that someone's kind of, very quickly, someone's obsessed about certain things. And you kind of, the obsession defines them or whatever. The Buddha, it said, has been set free and his mind cannot be defined. That's what we celebrate today. So hopefully it's a very modern discovery. Modern enough for you. And what I offered you tonight was my reflections, my contemplations on the Buddha. And I encourage you to have your own. Maybe yours will be a little bit different. But I think that it's a wonderful contemplation. And I think the world desperately needs people who discover some of the wisdom, some of the compassion, and some of the peace that the Buddha represents. So may this wonderful full moon night inspire you to take a second look at your profound capacity for self-reflection. And maybe you'll even sit up into the night, meditating or looking out the window, contemplating where the freedom and profundity is in your self-reflective mind. Can you discover the self-reflective mind that you have that has no definition? That cannot be defined, cannot be limited. So, thank you very much.